Are we going?
Into podcast.
Potter Who Cast.
Advertiser call.
Billis Major at your service.
Don't forget me.
Sarah, did you forget me?
Oh, let's go, that's class!
There is no such thing as...
I'm trying to think of a good way to introduce. No, I was going to say that's me falling to someone's body, but no. I don't know. Like, hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Yeah. we're all very enthusiastic about this opportunity today.
Yeah, to the listeners, I think what just happened is David had their soul replaced with the soul of actress Saran Jones. And so they're really confused right now.
Mona Lisa's Revenge. Pow pow.
Mona Lisa.
Remember Mona Lisa's Revenge? Remember just that whole story? Remember how
do
great
I?
That,
I
remember
don't.
How much we enjoyed that one?
When I actually don't remember it.
It's the one where
I have no idea what that even is.
It's a Sarah Jane adventure story where the Mona Lisa is loaned out to a random like bumfuck art gallery in London.
I forgot about that part of the plot.
It turns out she's an alien and she escapes from her painting and tries to... It's like someone famous as like the curator who like falls in love with her or something and she tries to like manipulate him. I can't remember who it is, but it's not good. It's like Saran Jones as the Mona Lisa shooting a gun at like this
lady. She has like an accent, right?
Yeah, she's
like a purposefully non-Italian accent.
She has her natural like northern accent, I think is what it is.
And they also like take off her eyebrows. I mean, because that's kind of like the Mona Lisa's thing. So the whole time she just looks like she has no eyebrows. And she does not look. I'll send you a photo here so you can take a look at it and see for yourself if this looks in any way like the Mona Lisa, right? Right?
Yeah. She does not look unlike Weird Al Yankovic right there.
Oh my God, you are right. That is Weird Al Yankovic.
Speaking of famous people,
by the way, the guy who you were thinking of
is Jeff Rawl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is he famous?
He's Cedric Diggory's dad in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. The guy's like, my boy.
I just assume every British person was a random background character in a Harry Potter movie. Mm-hmm. So
he's also in Drop the Dead Donkey. I don't know.
That was kind of mean.
He was also in Doctor Who serial Frontios as Plantagenet.
Wow,
which we all remember. But yeah, I don't know. Thank you for coming. And next time you'll we're not talking about Mona Lisa's Revenge.
Frontios. I'm sorry, what was going on in the Doctor Who offices during the Peter Davison era? That the names of their serials are just...
It's funny you say that.
Because the Doctor's Wife
this
was...
This is off the dome. I'm pretty sure Jonathan Turner used the Doctor's Wife as a leak catcher title. So he's put on the board being like, I'm going to do the Doctor's Wife next. And then he'd see who leaked it out and then be like, we fooled you. We're not doing that. You're nicked. You're going to jail. Or fired, whichever one.
It's funny that people still care about things leaking nowadays. Like, there's just, it's just like, I just want one movie or a TV show to be like, we don't give a shit, leak away, whatever. Like, who cares? Who cares?
Happened, technically speaking, when they, like, when they were filming the 60th, and they were like, all the fans were going to show up and take photographs, so you might as well just, like, you know, let them take photographs. And then Russell was like, they leaked way too much. They took way too many photographs. We shouldn't have let them do that. That was a mistake by us, which is why I think Series 2 kind of like didn't have that much kind of on-set presence. People like, is when you see like a lot of people were kind of posting from Series 2's set being like, I just saw this person or that person.
Everything leaked and it did not matter, right? Like, at no point in my watching, I'm so sorry. Can we introduce our guest? Because we're talking.
Yeah.
Because I want to hear your opinion too on this.
On the photo set leaks or the episode?
Anything.
Just anything, because I genuinely don't think there were at no point during watching series 14 series 14 did I ever go like, man, I wish this had not been leaked. There is one instance in the entire history of modern Doctor Who where I have thought the words, I wish I did not know this before the episode started, and it's in series 10. Mm-hmm. And I feel people know what that one is, and in that one it wasn't a leak, it was literally official marketing. So the thing about leaks is that they're just contextless shots. You know, we knew Mel was going to be seeing a shot of Mel in a motorbike with Shuji didn't like make me go, man, now I don't care. I don't care, but not because it leaked.
Exactly. And I feel like I'm really emblematic of the sort of fan they wanted to like bring back into the series. Someone who is really with it through the like Matt Smith and into the Capaldi era, who just kind of like naturally fell off with the show as it went on. And all of those set leaks only made me like excited to return to the show. Like, I wanted to see the context for the new costumes, new monster designs. I was thrilled to see that Catherine Tate was going to be back. I'm all for it. Like, it doesn't affect my enjoyment. I don't know, because I think I'm a normal person.
No, definitely. You are a normal person.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's only the freaks who really care about going into an experience like completely pure, no context whatsoever. They're just trying to like capture some sort of bottled magic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Freaks like Neil Gaiman.
We'll get to that. I just want to point out, you said we should introduce our...
We did not introduce, yeah. Please go ahead, David.
Who has fallen onto this Michael Sheen-voiced planet with us?
It's me. My name is CC McLaughlin. I responded to a mysterious white cube that appeared at my door one day that told me to go to a little bubble dimension outside the podcast universe, or perhaps a drain through which everything falls through into this podcast.
Speaking of drains, the doctor's wife goes down the drain, because I think we're going to shock people by saying how much we did not enjoy it. May 14th.
And I think we should start off, because I feel like maybe some people might have a grudge to bear. I can safely say my reasons for not enjoying this story have nothing to do with the actions of Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
His actions did not help. But it has nothing to do I can tell you it has one. We'll get into it as we talk about the episode.
So May 14th, 2011, May the 14th be with you, was when this came out, written by Neil Gaiman and directed by Richard Clarke. Richard Clarke's back, said no one, because Richard Clarke, do you know what the last two things Richard Clarke did for this endeavor?
I did not. Can you tell me?
He directed Gridlock and The Lazarus Experiment.
Those weren't bad.
But The Lazarus Experiment is maybe not the kind of thing you want in your CV, to be honest with you. But he's back. He's back. I think he comes back again. I don't know. I didn't check. In a sentence, Michael Sheen tricks Doctor Who into coming to a planet so he can eat him. The TARDIS goes into the Mona Lisa of Mona Lisa's revenge and they banish it or whatever. No, it's kind of... I understand why. Let me just say it first of all. I understand why. But it's kind of insane that Doctor Who falls for the trap.
Yes, it is the most obvious. There's so many moments in the story where the story is like, it's like waving its hands around for you to not notice the stupidest decision ever. There's a little bit of a production tidbit that I read that I think symbolizes exactly that, which you just said, which is my main problem with the story, which is Neil Gaiman incorrectly attributed the pull to open instruction on the TARDIS as referring to police box doors. While true that police boxes traditionally open outwards, the sign itself refers directly to the panel concealing the telephone. Now, that's a nitpick, but I think it represents the problem with the story where it's doing something and you go, oh, that's pretty interesting, and then whatever amount of time passes, be it in this case of this watch, 5 minutes, or in this case of the first watch, a couple of years, you go, oh, that wasn't interesting at all. That was just kind of repetitive and plotting and very, very simplistic and actually kind of wrong, too. That's basically my entire opinion on this episode.
Yeah. I really don't know. Like, I don't know. There's so much just to latch on to. But first, I want to see what your thoughts in general are on this endeavor.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed this episode when it first came out. Like, when it dropped, I was, again, a very emblematic, like, kind of Tumblr fan of the show. So just those odd moments of the Doctor interacting with Idris were just, like, really beautiful to me. And I thought really created some, like, interesting new moments for the series. But now that I'm looking back on the episode, I really just see how lopsided it is, how it feels like just two different plots, like, really inelegantly fused together. This one, like, on this, living Michael Sheen planet, the kind of interest of getting to touch a little bit of Time Lord culture again and being able to talk to the TARDIS, versus what I think is, like, a really, like, sadistic and no fun the TARDIS comes alive and tries to, like, destroy Amy and Rory sort of thing. Like, those two different plot points that they're traveling between just don't come together for me at all. And so by the end, you just get this, like, really lopsided episode of a bunch of very interesting moments with no elegant connective tissue between them.
Exactly. And also, the TARDIS is not a character. When you say lopsided, it's very lopsided in the sense that Idris as a character is basically just like a sounding board for the Doctor. Like, the episode claims to be, oh, like, what if the TARDIS could talk? Let's find out what the TARDIS thinks. I know what the TARDIS thinks about, like, one or two things. But most of what I think or know about the TARDIS is that the Doctor thinks she's sexy. Like, it's very reductive, honestly.
I have four words for you. Manic pixie dream TARDIS.
Yeah, it's I hate that word because I think that word is often thrown at, like, female characters just to describe them. But in this case, it is that. It is basically like a character whose sole purpose is to go, oh, I'm saying this, I'm saying that, but you are awesome, Doctor, and you're great. But also, I wanted to say this, and you are so cool. And it's like, this is the end result of 700 years of their relationship. When I was watching Doctor Who, I never thought they didn't talk. I mean, I'm not in the sense of, like, I don't think they've ever had, like, a face-to-face conversation, but I always got the vibe that the Doctor understands the TARDIS on, like, a deeper level than most people. You know, like that guy from the Onion with the Muppets. He just understands it and communicates with it in a language that people don't understand. And so they have their first conversation and it's about how, oh, you call me sexy. And it's like, again, it's the most Peter sex haver thing ever. Like, I too know what sex is. It just feels like two people performing what they think a sexual relationship should look like. And it's a dry run for an for the River Song relationship, which I don't think they nail until Peter Capaldi. So to me, it just feels like you've taken, like, let's finally do this thing we've been building up for 50-ish years of let's give the TARDIS a voice. And all she can say is how the Doctor calls her sexy. I'm like, really? That's it? That's all you can come up with?
Hmm. This is one that I've never really, like, gelled with.
I'm still trying to process my thoughts about the episode too. I guess I've overall liked Saran Jones's performance. I don't really see her as embodying, like, the TARDIS that we've been seeing for decades. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm seeing, like, this one aspect of the TARDIS's personality being filtered through, like, this mortal dying person. And just all the overwhelming, like, thoughts and emotions that would come from, like, putting an 11th dimensional being into a mortal body. That's been interesting to me. You know, this episode has always left me feeling like I want to see more of Idris, that I want to see, like, more of that relationship and her as a character develop. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the nature of this episode is she just gets, like, you know, buried and silenced immediately.
Well, look, if Nicholas Briggs is listening, you know, don't write him off, because, you know, before you know it, there could be a 63rd anniversary special where it's like the Idris Chronicles and Winston Churchill.
Oh, I'm sure.
They're all doing stuff.
I feel like she's one of those, like, characters held behind glass, like, break in case of emergency.
I suppose, like, Saran Jones probably also threatened to hit him with her car if he ever showed up at her house. Be like, do you want to do this? she just holds up her car keys and goes like, no. he just goes like, okay.
I like to imagine that if that does happen, like, for the 70th anniversary, there is an Idris and Fourth Doctor, and you look at the backstage page and it says recorded in 2017.
Oh, it's
how is this how is this possible? you announced it.
There was one recently where, like, it came out this year and it was recorded in, like, 2020, I think, or 2021. And I was like, Jesus Christ. Like, I don't know.
The latest Fourth Doctor adventures, The Curse of Time, released December 2024, was recorded on October 2023. Well, that's not too bad.
No. Myth busted. Speaking of busted,
does it make you feel good?
No. All these people are just thrown together, literally. One of the problems for me as well, and it's kind of, like, unavoidable in terms of how it's, you know, how everything works out. House, one, doesn't commit medical malpractice, so, you know, mm-hmm. not interested. two, doesn't pull a glove off his hand with his mouth in the promo picture. Not interested. And three, is just not interesting at all. He's just like, it's Michael Sheen, like...
Michael Why Sheen's do you get Michael yeah. Sheen and make him do an Adam Driver voice? I don't understand that.
He's just they've just like pitch shifted and like bass boosted his voice down to like 5 octaves lower. Like you could at least tell him, like, can you, like, just give us, like, something rather than just, you know, talking like this the entire time. Hello, how are you doing? You know, it just feels like, and like all his lines were kind of like empty, kind of, you know, I'll get you, ha ha ha, kind of things. Like, it just feels not so much a waste, because, like, I didn't even know it was him until, like, years later.
Same. But,
like, it just feels like an underbaked villain, and, like, you're relying then as well. This is another thing. It's relies so much on iconography to the point where it just feels silly. Like,
mm-hmm.
the Ood. The one of the funniest bits is when Matt Smith's like, oh yeah, I killed another Ood. Oops. Anyway.
he's well.
Like another Uday field to save. Okay, anyway. But like the, also like the ninth and tenth interior that they should pop up is just like it feels like I don't even know what it feels like. They
it's pandering. It's pandering. Just pure fan service.
Yeah. The thing as well is that like I think, and this ties into it as well, and this is kind of my overriding point in terms of like the iconography. I think it's kind of impossible to depict the inside of the ship because it's like you're just showing corridors. Like no matter what you're doing, it's just a load of corridors, and maybe sometimes you see like a fun room, but it's always just like corridors.
Don't worry, they're going to try it three more times.
That's mostly corridors as well. Like the next time, it's mostly corridors again, though. That's 2 years later, and that's like literally an episode that's about the inside of it. And they're like, "Yeah, it's corridors. It's just little corridors, you know."
This is the best one because this is the best version of that idea because there is something this episode does get, which is that if it's the Doctor lost in the TARDIS, you're just gonna go like, "Don't you fucking know your own house?" But if it's if it's Amy and Rory, these like two normal people. It becomes 10 times worse. I think the idea of being lost in an alien ship is inherently scary, even if people don't think about it. And to me, that is the best moment of the episode because something is happening. One, something is happening in the story, which is great. And then two, it's this familiar thing being twisted into unfamiliar territory. Which is kind of what the Idris plotline is supposed to do, if they would get like, their heads out of their pants for like 5 seconds.
Yep.
There's that bit where like she's looking at the graveyard. She's like, I'm looking at all my dead sisters, and the doctor's like, oh, awkward. And then they move on, and I'm like, no, go back. That's what I want to see more of.
Absolutely.
They had to move on because they had to. Bring in the blue Peter winning custom console that barely gets used.
Did the person who did this know that it's that the end result of their work is that it's trash?
I hope so.
Okay. Just can't imagine a kid being like, I made my TARDIS to get to the set. Look at this shitty TARDIS. This is the shittiest TARDIS in the world.
You are a proper fucking idiot for doing
the confidential guy when the Doctor Who production team needed to look for a shitty TARDIS, they turned to this 10-year-old.
How does it feel to be a failure and a piece of shit?
shows his name as like shit TARDIS creator in the bottom.
But one of the things like within that iconography that is also itself iconography is the fact that we have yet another kind of instance of Amy and Rory kind of being at each other's necks, so to speak. Like it's obviously like only like a 2 second interval in like this entire thing, but like the way this season plays with the idea of them like, you know, as a couple, it just feels so volatile all the time.
Yeah, like, it really it does. Just,
like in the we've already talked about this like last time, but not last time, but a couple of times ago. But we're like, there's a whole thing of like, you know, Amy uses very non-specific terms where to talk about like the baby and her relationship and who she likes, and then Rory takes that as like, oh, she means the doctor, even though she could just say like, you know, oh, Rory. Then like next week, like there's a whole thing of Rory getting tricked and like betraying Amy again. And then like it feels very circular and very kind of just like at this point playing the hits or like just kind of spinning wheels. But it's obviously like a huge part of it, but like it just sometimes you kind of wish this did more with those two people than what they ended up doing. And I think next season it gets to like the point where it just feels like they've run out of ideas and they just keep replaying that kind of conflict a little bit. But I don't know, like one thing we can't forget is that we're talking about a Hugo Award winning
Oh my god!
Story.
I looked at the other nominees and I'm mad.
Can I talk you through them?
Yeah, because please do.
One of them makes no sense to me until I watched what it was. So the nominees were The Doctor's Wife, then The Girl Who Waited, which we have to wait to get to that one. A Good Man Goes to War, which I think is a good nomination. Then you have two more. You have Community Remedial Chaos Theory, which...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form, I should say. And I want you to remember the name Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form, because the fifth nominee is a Hugo speech. It's the Drink Tank's Hugo Acceptance Speech, which I had to look this up because I was confused. The year before, a guy won Best Fanzine, and they nominated the speech for Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form. And the speech is literally going like, I can't believe I won this. Oh my God, this is crazy. And I was like, why did they nominate this? And then they get to the end of the speech and this guy goes like, that'll be one of the nominees next year for Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form.
Oh, shut the fuck up.
And so they nominated.
I thought you were building up to, and then he revealed that like he shot a short for his acceptance, and it, like, it's a whole presentation. It's a joke. I like that it's a joke, but I'm just like, I would have rather the joke one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that's just, it's just, like, indicative of where we were in, like, 2011, in a sense. Like, I feel like this season kind of gets singled out a lot as being, like, confusing, but also like incredible. And I think it's great. I don't think it's that confused. I think the confusion comes in from...
You're looking at it backward. Yeah. You're looking at it from the perspective of, you know where this is going. And so you're trying to find out if the clues fit together, and they don't, because the clues were just being put in place as they went.
Yeah.
So you can't really find anything. I was wondering about that just now, because you just said, like, that's the most 2011 thing. How much are we soured on this episode? Because we have been through almost like 15 years of, now everyone does this kind of story where it's like, oh, here's the thing you love as a fan, and they're making the jokes you love as a fan, and they're making the references you love as a fan, and here's the ood. Like, when they go to the previous TARDIS console room, I instinctively went, ugh. But I was like, why did I do that? Because, like, it's not a bad scene. There's no moment where the 11th Doctor stops and goes like, oh, I remember this console. This is where I told Rose to go to bus. That doesn't happen. He doesn't pull off a... they don't go into the console room and there's, like, a tarp under it. They pull it while, like, a twinkly version of the Doctor Who theme plays. You know, there's none of that. It's just they go into the concert room, they say, oh, it's another concert room, and that just scene just happens. I just wonder, but it's been 14 years of, like, this kind of writing being the go-to form of writing for every single franchise. Yeah. So I wonder just how much of this is that we're going back to it and we're looking like, oh my God, this was like the beginning of this awful, awful era. Just like how, you know, nominating an acceptance speech because the guy said, oh, this is going to be the nominee next year, is like peak 2011, because it is the same kind of ha ha ha, isn't the internet funny kind of stuff that 5 years later would destroy the world.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so it's literally prioritizing self-referential humor over like acknowledging anyone else in your community, the thing that your award show is theoretically about.
Yeah. So I wonder just how much of it is us coming from like our 2011 selves being like, yes, this is fun. Are the things we like are being recognized? And then it's our 2024 selves being like, you have no idea. Just you could have too much of a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a lot of it. You know, that was kind of my ultimate takeaway revisiting this episode, that I think, like, the line where, you know, Idris says that are people always like this, so much bigger on the inside. Like, when I first watched that, I thought that was like a, you know, top 10, like, Doctor Who history moment. Like, it blew me away. I definitely fucking cried. I still think it's kind of like a beautiful sentiment. But that's only because it reflects decades of, like, thematic ideas that they've been building into this story. It touches on like what the very core, what I think is beautiful about Doctor Who, that you can be this like immortal alien traveling between worlds and dimensions and historical events, and that the most like incredible, precious thing you keep returning to Earth for is just regular human lives. Like, that's an amazing sentiment, but it's being delivered through this like self-referential, simple inversion. Like, it's only impactful, not because of anything like Gaiman introduced into the story, but just because he is riffing on something that other writers and performers have been working on for decades. And the line itself isn't even like particularly special. It's just like a very simple inversion, like of one of the series catchphrases, which like anyone can do for any form of media. Like may you be with the Force.
Yeah.
Is or power in the case always of like this? Is power always like this? It comes with such great responsibility.
Or you could do what Alien Romulus did and just have them say the line. Get away from her, you bitch. Even though it makes you go, why did you just say that? Yeah. Like, imagine if you were just walking normally, you're walking with a friend, you know, just having like a normal conversation, and your friend turns to you, I do have an offer you can't refuse. and then you look at them and you go like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
Can I just I just noticed this. I need both of you to react to this like right now.
Yeah.
So this also won the 2011 Ray Bradbury Award for Outstanding Dramatic Presentation. Can I read to you the nominees of this award that it beat? Because my eyes just kind of lit up when I saw what it beat. I'll give you an example of what won the year before. So the year before, Inception won, okay? So it's like up against movies and stuff.
Okay.
So also Vincent and the Doctor was nominated the year before as well.
Makes sense.
So this year, the Doctor's Wife beat out, and I'll read you them in order of like things that make sense to me, and then things where I'm like, that's a funny nominee for this. Captain America the First Avenger, it beat out that. It beat out Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
What?
Source Code, right. Attack the Block, Hugo, and The Adjustment Bureau. And the next time it was nominated was 2014 with Day of the Doctor, which it lost in 2014.
To who?
It lost to Gravity. It was up against Her, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Pacific Rim, and a movie called Europa Report. But yeah, it's an odd duck of an award thing, because it only gets nominated again until... Does it get nominated again after Day of the Doctor? I have a feeling it won't get nominated again after Day of the Doctor, because there's no episode where like I'm feeling like, oh, that will be a nomination.
The people care about that episode?
Yeah. It's, I don't know. Like, hang on. I'm scrolling through this. No, didn't get nominated again. There's some really weird...
Oh, but relax. Everybody, don't worry. Don't worry, guys. Don't worry. Because, hey, they definitely nominated. They definitely nominated The Good Place several times.
They did. I'm looking at the Hugo Awards now. I'm just scrolling through the Hugo Awards. So the next time like the Hugo Awards take notice are next, like the next year, where Asylum of the Daleks and Angels Take Manhattan and The Snowman all get nominated, but they all lose to Game of Thrones episode Blackwater. I've never seen Game of Thrones. I don't know if that's a big one. Then the 2014 Hugos are very strange, because They nominate Adventure in Space and Time, which is a cool nomination. Day of the Doctor, Name of the Doctor, the Five-ish Doctors reboot gets nominated as well.
Oh, okay.
An Orphan Black episode gets nominated, but the winner is Reigns of Castamere from Game of Thrones. And then Listen gets nominated in 2015, but loses to Orphan Black. And then Heaven Sent gets nominated in 2016. And loses to Jessica Jones episode AKA Smile, and is up against Grimm episode Headache, My Little Pony Friendship is Magic episode The Cutie Map parts 1 and 2, and Supernatural is Just My Imagination. And then this is me reading off a Wikipedia page, but like the one thing here that's popped out to me is the return of Dr. Mysterio was nominated against San Junipero from Black Mirror, Battle of the Bastards from Game of Thrones, The Door from Game of Thrones, something called Splendor and Misery, and they all lost to The Expanse, Leviathan Wakes. So it's like, it's a show that keeps getting nominated for Hugos, but I think that the Hugos kind of like, it feels like the Hugos kind of become less important, which is another thing. Like 2011, the Hugos are huge. Whereas
all
like,
awards become less important.
If you, like, if you told me, oh yeah, by the way, in like 2024, the Giggle will be nominated for a Hugo. I'd be like, and Wild Blue Yonder as well. I'd be like, yeah, cool. But like, some of these nominations are just like. Do you want to know what Chibnall episodes got nominated for a Hugo? And go lost the place. Rosa. Teams of the Punjab and Resolution all got nominated for Hugo, and Fugitive of the Dune as well, and not Power of the Doctor, interestingly enough.
All of those sound like reasonable nominees.
It's like all the big episodes that get nominated, and then, you know, they don't do the acceptance speech gambit again. One, I am in and out of having like a headache, so if I seem off, that's why. But the two, I just don't really have like. This is the problem I had with Blink, and this is the problem I had with other stuff, where like it's of a certain way where like I just like I intersect with an episode a certain way wherein I just don't find myself having a lot to say that isn't just I'd like this or I didn't like this, and this is one where like. This is where I understand and appreciate what the effort was and what the input was and what like the attempt was, but it's just always, it's like oil and water with me. It just doesn't ever kind of sit with me in the way where like I'd rather watch like the Flesh two-parter again than watch this again, or like, you know, I don't know. It's not one that like I'm particularly fond of. And it's not one that can really like rise myself up to like be like, you know, time to meet this head on, because when I meet this head on, I'm just like, yeah, okay, floating cubes. There's obviously no way they could have done this, but I think if you brought the Corsair into it more, if the house is like controlling the Corsair's body when he arrives, and then like it's like a reveal like, oh, the Corsair is dead the entire time. It's actually, you know, this thing inside of it that's actually been like piloting this body around. Like, I think House just needs to have more of like a presence, and I think it just needs like something like that where like it's in like something that isn't just the planet, because like you don't really get much of like an input from
that's
the planet.
A really good idea,
like
to have the Corsair there, and then it reveals that it's House.
It makes a bit more sense then, because then when he shows up and he sees like, oh, like there's another Time Lord here. Oh my God, great. You know, I'm not the only one left. Rather than him showing up and being like, yeah, this was a trap, wasn't it? Okay, I'm going to go and just look around and, you know.
Yeah, because they even reference, what's his name? Uncle, right? Uncle having like the Corsair's arms as part of his body. So you could even have like a little lingering remnant of the Corsair's mind or something be able to speak through him. And that's kind of what I meant by the episode being so lopsided. They set up so many interesting ideas, but then shift the entire plot to focus for like 10 minutes on this like completely different horror episode sequence that I would rather have seen like these two separate ideas, like each have their own episode rather than this awkward fusion.
Yeah.
I also think the problem with that sequence is that Amy is doing like, at no point do they ever try to just hold hands. Like I had that thought.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, don't let go.
Don't let go. Like, clearly, God. Like the first beat is they go through, the doors close, and then they want, and then she goes around and like, oh, I just walked through, but for you, time has passed. Okay, then let's hold hands and not separate. Mm-hmm. Let's walk side by side. Nope. They immediately walk ahead, and the same thing happens, and we just end with like a shot of A being like, oh, like, what did you think was going to happen? Like, you just did it.
Yeah, they're not acting like characters in a situation. They're acting like, you know, actors being guided from plot point A to plot point B.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I like the beats with, like, oh, then she finds him old, and then she finds him dead. But then they just kind of move on from that. I was like, oh, they're going to make a connection between that and the whole, like, thing that they brought up at the beginning of Amy being like, oh, I know we saw him die, but, like, still weird, you know. Like, but no, it was just unconnected, you know. It was just, it was just, hey, and here's a horror story, and bye. Which is why it's still my favorite part of the episode, because I still think it was, like, the most effective one, personally speaking. And I will also say, I think, on top of what you guys have said, it would make it, this episode work a little bit better. I think the problem is that because we know that it's a trap from the beginning, if we just don't see Idris at the start, we just stay with the Doctor. It's like, oh, there's more Time Lords titles. Oh, the Doctor's wife. Oh, wait, could the Doctor's wife be one of those Time Lords? All right, let's go. Oh, we're here. Wait, where's everybody? Oh, no, we're trapped. See, now it's a mystery. Instead of the Doctor going into the most obvious trap of the world. Which it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
There's still one good moment, which I really like, which is when the Doctor's like, well, wouldn't you want to be forgived? I was like, yeah, yeah, that's a really good one. That was a really, really good beat of the Doctor's arc. Which they were going to wrap up by having Idris be like, I forgive you, before she dies. But then they decided to cut that. There's so much cut stuff. I read all of it. There's so much cut stuff for this episode. Almost like Neil Gaiman. It's not a good... The writes too much.
Well, that was a big thing, wasn't it? Like, it got way too big or something, and they had to, like, push it off for a year or something.
There was going to be a scene, like, the fucking swimming pool was going to come back. Like, again, that's like the sort of thing that's like, you are so concerned about bringing back the swimming pool, really? Like that one place where that Centauran trip next to, that's what we're gonna put all our budget to? And they're like, yeah, no swimming pool, but the joke's still there. And so you're just left with, like, these references to things that you would rather be watching than this.
That's actually a good point. And again, I'm just reading the Wikipedia page now. It was written for Series 5, and it was going to be where the Lodger was, and then he had to, like, push it a year ahead because, like, you know, budget stuff, all these rewrites and stuff. But he had to add in Rory, so that's where all, like, the horror stuff comes in, because suddenly he has another character he has to incorporate. So he has to add in, like, you know, something for Amy and Rory to do. And that becomes, they go into the thing and get chased around corridors. And like, at that point, it's like, could you not have thought of something else within that kind of sphere? Because, like, obviously his original idea is they're going, like, the Doctor gets chased through the TARDIS by something. Could you not just instead be like, you know, maybe they have something better to do? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Just reading all the, like, just scrolling through Wikipedia, I think the production thing is just like, I don't know, it feels like something that's maybe a victim as well to a mix of, like, too many ideas and too little money, and both of them collide together into this. And, you know, we'll get back to him, like, next season, but, like, in, like, Nightmare in Silver, it feels like the ultimate version of too many ideas, too little money, and then also no input from the guy running this, so you're running on your own, and you're, like, you're basically flying by the seat of your pants, doing your own revisions and stuff. And it just feels like, it feels like, this is going to be a weird comparison, it feels like fan casting, where you like pluck this person and we're like, this guy would be perfect for this, and then you realize, oh, actually these two were never meant to be involved because it's actually a really poor match. There's no energy here, there's no, like, you know, it's a really poor kind of marriage of two things. Like, when people are like, you know, oh, Tom Holland should play, like, I don't know, this guy, or, you know, you got to cast John Krasinski as Mr. Fantastic. Why wouldn't you? Look at him. He's got that look. It's like these energies don't mesh, but people have built up this idea in their head, like, oh, these two would go perfectly together. Because, you know, Neil Gaiman writes all these, like, wild, kind of crazy, kind of, like, you know, fantasy stylist things that, like, you know, so much character, so much whatever, that, like, it can't fail. And then it turns out, oh, he's got, like, he's way too ambitious for what this is. He's got really any idea of TV.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes to show what a unique beast writing for television is. That's not just something you can take a writer successful in another genre from and expect them to successfully succeed. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, a lot of Gaiman's projects, whether it be like Sandman or Good Omens, they've kind of suffered from being overstuffed with ideas that if you had a novel's, you know, length worth of time, maybe it would work out. But in this, like, production machinery, you can just really see that it seemed like he was bumping against, like, everything else the production was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, jumping on what you said about this being a very icon-first type of storytelling, this is the most icon-first season of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no wonder that this is, like, the show ramping up to the height of its popularity in recent years, because it is the most, like, and here's, like, we're gonna get these icons. And when we say icon, we don't mean like legendary things. We mean in the sense of like images. They're not really characters. They're more just like concepts and symbols. So you have the TARDIS. That's why you have Nixon in the opening with the moon landing. That's why you have the pirates. That's why you have the Flash. That's why you have A Good Man Goes to War. That's why they go clue Hitler. It just feels like this is like, what if it almost feels like someone was like, guys, next year Doctor Who's gonna get canceled, so let's put all these ideas out right now. And I think the problem is that once you get to series 7, you can kind of feel them going, wait, let's just do it again. Oh, wait, if we just do it again, there's nothing to build up on. Like, there's just, I think what Moffat lacks from the previous eras, and this is something that's very noticeable, especially having just seen them and having seen Russell T. Davies come back, and he's missing this too, which is, I think Moffat really focuses on the icon, the iconography. He can make these things feel bigger than life. Mm-hmm. But when you lose that grounding of a character, which is what RTD did so well by having those domestic scenes, by having us go so back, by introducing us to so many family members of each of these characters. This is something that Moffat is trying to build up in Series 6. But when all of that goes away with Amy and Rory leaving in Series 7, you kind of have the second half of Series 7 where it feels like the gang's trying to do the same thing, but something's changed because now you don't have those characters anymore. You just have these icons. You just have the Impossible Girl, where it's not so much that with Amy, and I'm sorry, this is getting to a conversation about the future of the show. With Amy and Rory and even River, the core of their characters is the reason we've come back to watch them is their characters. You know, we like the way they talk and they act, and we like the way they interact with the Doctor. Whereas Clara is a character who's introduced with the reason you want to see her come back is because you want to know what's the deal with her.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the modus operandi for every single form of main storytelling. It becomes a mystery box world. And like Star Wars becomes this, Star Trek becomes this, Doctor Who becomes this. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes about the icons, it becomes about the symbols, it becomes about the mysteries. And this is the beginning. This is like the poison pill that we swallowed to get Series 7 and then to get the show that we eventually get.
Yeah, I think, you know, art as a whole, art only has an impact if it is related to human lives, to the lives of the people who are experiencing the piece of media itself. Unless it's reflecting something on that, like, human psychological level, it's just going to end up being goop. And I think we're definitely in an era of storytelling now where people are only focused on the goop and completely forgetting the human factor that makes everything else impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a hot take, which is that I don't think any companion after Amy, except for one, manages to avoid that problem where they're less about Doctor Who, the show, and more about, oh, I'm a character and I have my own plot within Doctor Who, the show. Like, there's only one character who does that, and it's Bill, in my opinion. I think everyone, every single companion after this, I think Clara has this problem. I think all of 13's companions have this problem. I think Donna coming back has this problem too. I think Ruby has this problem, where all of them have a thing. They have a mystery. They have a thing that needs to be solved because it is Doctor Who, and you can't just be a normal person. So we need to figure out what Clara's deal is. We need to figure out, and then, except for the Chibnall characters, I guess, because they don't really have a deal. I guess their deal is to figure out what the Doctor's deal is. So it just it becomes very recursive, and it looks inward. Like, Ruby's deal is, what is the mystery with Ruby? Why was she abandoned? What was she, as opposed to, we want to follow her on her adventures because we got attached to her and engaged with her.
Yeah.
Didn't you say we were going to record 30 minutes of this one, David?
I just didn't really think we had much.
You really didn't think I was going to turn this into a treatise on the future of Doctor Who? I do this for every episode, David. You should have learned better.
I thought you were going to reveal that you were the one who gave the speech that almost won a Hugo.
I will give you a fun fact. I just found out that there's this Doctor Who audio with the fourth Doctor releasing in September 2025. So that's like literally almost a year into the future. Do you guys want to guess when it was recorded?
2019.
I'm going to say 2021.
No, 2018.
Jesus Christ.
Damn.
It will come out almost 7 years after it was recorded.
It's like a bourbon. You can only really start enjoying it after 5 years. Come on.
Devil works hard, but Nick Briggs works harder. Which is, you're starting to have this problem with Tom and Colin Baker, where their voices are different now. And so you have stuff where they just sound different, and then you have new stuff where they sound like they sounded before. And it's like, we got to accept they just sound different, guys. It's fine. People get old.
I think that's why, in part, obviously, one of the reasons they went for Jodie and Amanda Gill is that, like, obviously, you know, it's huge news. Like, oh, you know, we've already got these guys signed up. But also, it's like, we can maybe start shifting away from, you know.
It's new people. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have to worry about them, like, you know, sounding old or sounding like, you know, or worrying about, like, oh, we only have like a finite amount of time with these people left. Let's not make them, you know, get into a booth and record like 29 hours of audio every day.
I mean, we already have the TV show wasting Paul McGann. Like, we got to put them to use. I mean, I think they just got to bite the bullet and do like the big finish doctor and get somebody who's not going to be able to play him on TV, but could do it on the big finish medium.
Well, that's what they did with David Warner. And then obviously David Warner sadly passed away, but like they just need, I think the problem is, and I think Briggs said himself, they couldn't do any more Unbound Doctor stuff that wasn't already like, you know, whatever, because the BBC told them you can't cast your own Doctor anymore. You have to use our people. That's why Colin Baker became the War Doctor for like a box set, because they weren't allowed to use anyone else. So they just got Colin Baker to do it.
Oh my god.
Which is just it's silly, but like, you know.
Can you someone explain to me how BBC how we can do this and then turn around and canonize Scream of the Shauka in a random episode? Like, is canon real or is it not? Like, let's just decide.
That's the thing, though. Like, I think it won't happen because Richard E. Grant. I don't think. Because that was an original Richard E. Grant photograph they used. They went and like took photographs of him to use for that thing. But I think if like Nick Briggs for like Richard, you only like do this, he'd be like, no, I'm good, thanks. You know, I'm okay.
No, I mean in the sense that like.
I know what you mean, but
if
I think
the
like,
yeah. I if the problem is we can't have new doctors because we got to keep it consistent, then don't go on a TV show and like, and here's that random doctor from one thing.
Now, I will say the thing about that is the VFX people were like, it was basically our call, what we wanted to do. And we were like, why don't we do Richard E. Grant? And I got signed off on by the honchos that be. rather than being like in the script. Oh, and then you see Richard E. Grant floating around.
Oh, interesting.
But
like, interesting.
At the same time, it is just like, I don't want to be rude to Big Finish, but like overestimate how many people are paying attention to Big Finish to be like, isn't it confusing that they have their own original guy playing this guy? Like, no one's going to care. Like, I guarantee you, if you were to poll like people who watched series one, whether it's on BBC, whether it's on Disney Plus, whatever, you say, do you care about like this? They'd be like, what is Big Finish? What are you talking about? Because like, and this is maybe like, this is also the commentary on like, you know, where we are at the moment, but like, they are so expensive that I think people who aren't like already listening are getting priced out. And I'm not one for like, you know, just pandering to your audience, whatever, but like, I think they're getting to the point where they could afford just to like, you know, pander to their audience in a way that would be like, you know, here's our own original guy doing this. Enjoy, because no one else is buying these anymore.
Another episode that ends with us being scared for the show's future. Oh, well. Welcome to podcast.
Well, next week we're more scared for its past, and also, you know, we get a little juvenile as well, I'll put it that way.
It calls for it. It's the Flash episode. It's the Flash.
Yeah. So, Cece, do you want to like plug anything before you get yanked back into the real universe?
Yeah, I should have mentioned at the top of the episode, CC stands for Corsair Crush. Mm. I think the Corsair is just kind of one of the best things in this entire episode, so I just want to leave on that note. Want to see more of the Corsair. They seem really cool. You can find anything I'm working on my website, ccmclaughlin.com, which also has links to all of my social media for whatever platform still exists by the time that you're listening to this. And it is always a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Yeah, Michelle, is there anything you wanna skediddle-daddle about?
I don't, but thanks for asking. I just want to point out that the upcoming Master box set, the Sasha Dawn Master, that I'm very excited for. The cover art has the Sasha Dawn Master doing a crazy face and then doing a "but I'm also a gentleman" face. So I just wanted to highlight that. I love that. Love it. Master is good. A nerd. He's a nerd. I'm sorry. He's the world's biggest fucking nerd who has a crush on another nerd, and they just keep chasing each other and being nerds online.
I love it. It's such a good dynamic.
That's my AU fic that got me for a Hugo Award as well. Yeah, so nominate this for the best dramatic short presentation at the 2025 Hugo Awards. We should have probably predicted what from series one will get nominated. I can tell you now, I don't think anything will, besides maybe Rogue. We won't dwell any further on whether or not there's a cultural footprint anymore. But I don't know. Bye.
Wait, I do want to say one last thing. Sorry, I'm so sorry. I did want to bring up one last topic, which is I kind of hate that this episode gets credited with bringing up the idea of Time Lords changing genders in regeneration. That's any person could have fought that. Just please, I don't want to see that. And it just feels weird to be like, and you know who came up with that? Neil Gaiman. Like, no, he didn't. He just, everyone was. Had already, like, they had already done it in a joke special like 20 years earlier. Stop saying he came up with it. He didn't.
You heard it here first. Bye. I don't know. I'm gonna take a tablet and chill. I don't know. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Next time on Pod Tour, Who Cast?
The flesh. It's fully programmable matter.
It acts like life, but it still needs to be controlled by us.
They can't remain stable without us plumbed into them.
Trust me. I'm the Doctor.
I have a plan.
worried me.
And it'll destroy them all.
What?
You're one of us, Doctor.